So, do we have any questions?
I'm pretty much unanimous agreement, I think. I don't know if I can add anything.
Yeah. Well, I'll read your silence, so it's a no. Wowed agreement.
I was wondering how you view ontology in terms of Mason's typology. I mean, after Husserl says effectively that an object is the possibility of its further adumbration over time, which, you know, to me sounds like correlationism. It's in the sense saying that the objectivity of something consists of its relationship to a possible subject. I don't happen to agree with Husserl, but that seems like a fairly clear case of correlationism, and it's from one of the kind of major, modern philosophers. I accept there may be a variety of arguments that lead Husserl to that stage, but that seems like a pretty clear case.
Yeah, I think in a way. Phenomenology presents us with an interesting case, and Husserl in particular, I think it becomes increasingly difficult to resist the idea that there is something strongly correlationist going in, especially the later Husserl, and I think is it kind of ideas where he takes his very I was going to say Kantian term into my previous argument, but at least this traditional view of Kant, and as well in the talk I concentrate a lot on the idea of the correlationist circle, and of course Melissu talks about this idea of the correlationist two-step as well, so thinking about subjects as an object in a primal unity in some sense, and if we look to Heidegger, it's when it comes to this idea of the correlationist two-step, it's pretty hard to resist that there's certainly a lot in Heidegger which seems to correspond to that idea in particular. You know, when he says, we shall not speak of subjects and so on, but. So as I said, I don't think it's that there are no correlationists or it's a complete straw man, but there are bits and pieces of correlationist strategies, or at least strategies that look superficially like correlationism, and certainly the phenomenological tradition. But I think they're more limited and less extreme forms than the one that Melissu.
I agree with you in the sense I don't think correlationism is as impressive as Melissu seems to assume. I mean, I'm within analytic philosophy, that the move has tended to be, for example, to divorce epistemology from semantics. So in a sense, if you treat representation as non-epistemic, as a sort of, formal relation of reference, and then you can be explicator, perhaps in causal terms, then the idea, in a sense, it's not clear that we can even infer from the finite nature of our cognitive faculties to the non-representability of reality, because in a sense representation and knowledge peel off to some degree. So yeah, that's a comment, not a
question. Yeah.
I wondered if you had a response more directly to it. You know, it seems that when Mirsu attacks specifically transcendentalism within a Kantian context, he points towards the notion of the archaic fossil as this specific nub of argument for the reason this promotes the entire discussion, on the basis that we're talking about a position in time which is prior to all givenness, which that sounds like using Heideggerian phenomenological terms there, but it seems that could be applied back to Kant without too Husserlianizing the Kantian transcendental subject, at least not irrevocably so. So do you not think that applies to Kant? Do you think Kant can somehow escape the problem of the archifossil, and how?
Yes, in a sense. I find Mirsu's account of Kant in some ways quite misleading. So the things that in his discussion of Kant in relation to the arche fossil, so he picked upon this idea of in modern philosophy, what's had to happen is we've had to redefine objectivity, and we can't think of truth as adequation anymore in a kind of Platonic Aristotelian way, and so he points to these passages in the thing in the transcendental deduction, where there seems to be some kind of, he reads it as a redefinition of truth in terms of intersubjectivity, and that's what leads to all this kind of idea about, well, we have to reinterpret claims, ancestral statements, as about our reasons and what the community of scientists and so on, and that's how he tries to convict Kant of these problems with the arche fossil. But I think, it's kind of a tedious and boring point to make, but I fundamentally disagree with that idea that Kant is redefining truth in a modern context in terms of some kind of idea of subjectivity, which means that he can't then deal with these cases of the arche fossil. Insofar as I think what Meisu does is confuse the idea of publicity with the idea of intersubjectivity. So Kant is concerned with getting us to a public world, and there's certain conditions upon representations in which they're to be public. But I don't think those. I think he kind of misreads Kant when he starts thinking about that in terms of intersubjectivity, and that's what's meant to convict Kant, this supposed redefinition of truth. Whereas I think actually Kant has a quite traditional view of truth. He talks about truth as the interaction between an object and a judgment.
Do you not think that Meisu is as much using the transcendental aesthetic as the transcendental dialectic for his source in order to say just that, the Kantian model, time comes with the subject, what about the before the subject, what about the by definition before any subjects, how is there time there? It's a relatively simple point again, but it's not so much deriving from the dialectic but the aesthetic.
Yeah, well, the aesthetic is the weakest bit, and it's the weakest part of the first critique, and it is the bit which is most apt to be thought about in the heavily subjective terms. Now, at least some Kantian scholars have argued very strongly that we shouldn't give it the traditional spin in which time and space are just subjective properties which the subject introduces. So people like Henry Allison and Graham Bird and so on. But I agree that that's where the chink in the armour would be. So as I think I mentioned, I think some of Kant's arguments there are pretty ropey. But insofar as Meisu's discussion, what he tends to pick up on is this stuff about the example of the warming of the stone and that, which I think he kind of gets wrong. But as I say, it's kind of a bit of a boring point to say, well, hey, I read this figure differently than you read this figure. Well, if we're interested in the substantive philosophical point, maybe that's not so important.
Any other questions?
Thanks. I agree with, I think you're right about sort of what is problematic and unsatisfactory about Meisu's accounts. I guess it's very striking that he seems to take the again, the distinction between weak and strong correlation, which is in Kantianism in Fichte, Hegel, something like that. He seems curiously to kind of assume that the strong correlations critique is correct, that you can simply move from weak to strong correlations. And I think he's wrong about that. I think you're right to emphasize that Kantianism has the resources to kind of to respond and to deal with all these objections about ancestrality. But I'm interested in your account of, first of all, about the status of the aesthetic in Kant. One is the new Kantians try to reconcile the Kantian critical machinery with the revolution in kind of physics and mathematics at the turn of the last century. But they did it by excising the aesthetic completely, so that space and time became conceptual constructions. Now, one of the risks of doing that, and that's a very powerful move, one of the consequences of that is that you then, it means that the role, the kind of the mediating link between kind of sensibility and the understanding is obliterated or occluded. And then, you know, conceptual judgment seems to kind of float in this kind of ethereal realm that is untethered to any kind of perceptual experience. So, and then you do get a kind of the pressure mounts to kind of the kind of intersubjective correlationism that you just said Kant is not guilty of, if properly construed. So I wonder if you could say something about that, about what, in what way it's possible to kind of to hold on to Kant's claim about the way in which all our conceptual cognition is conditioned by sensibility, without construing space and time as forms of intuition. Because space and time are forms of intuition, you have to explain how they relate to nervous systems, and that's Meissou's point. Basically, Kant is not a phenomenalist, but every time, or often, the way in which you hear a kind of vulgar Kantian defense of ancestrality is in terms of this claim that, well, the way to get around this is just to say that, you know, had we been there to witness the accretion of the earth, we would experience it in exactly the way in which, you know, scientists currently. And that's a kind of phenomenalism which I don't think Kant wants to espouse at all. But then, could you say in what way the articulation of the aesthetic and of the understanding can be, you know, carried out without turning Kant into a phenomenalist and without lapsing into conceptual idealism?
Yeah, well, in terms of, I mean, I should emphasize I'm not a Kantian, but in terms of that problematic, it seems to me, as you say, well, Meissou's main point is that, well, what we'll have to do is think about the relation of, you know, the brain and brain sciences to this idea of the transcendental subject and so on. And there is, in After Finitude, there is an attempt to look at a kind of deeper, more subtle Kantianism. So the one response from this supposedly Kantian correlationist is this kind of phenomenalist counterfactual response. So, you know, if we were there, we would have seen it. And that's still in a subjectivist phenomenalist tradition. But then there's this other transcendental strategy which tries to say, well, no, you've misunderstood what a transcendental condition is. You've somehow subjectivized it, you've turned it into something that's existent, something that which is out there in the world, but actually it's a notion of a perspective, and it can't be ascribed a kind of existence. It's a condition for grasping certain things. And I mean, the way that Meissou tries to short circuit that kind of response is by saying, well, you know, we have to locate the transcendental subject in various ways. We have to relate it to the brain. We have to. Whereas, I think I disagree on that point about whether we can actually articulate transcendental conditions for the possibility of thought and representation in general without necessarily tying it to a living, breathing being within all their concrete finitude. I think it is possible to do that, but that's, you know, it's kind of quite tricky to condense that into a short answer. But that is certainly the point at which I disagree with his response to the response.
Okay, I think we're out of time now.